Chapter 10, Ordination and Installation. The decisive step of coming under care of presbytery with a view to ordination to the Christian ministry was finally taken by Machen in November 1913, when he was 32 years old. His license the following April, his election as assistant professor of New Testament at the May 1914 meeting of the board of directors, his ordination in June, and his installation to his professorship in May 1915 all received more publicity, but none was more memorable or marked more of a turning point in his life than his initial appearance before the presbytery. Having made the great decision that he was at last ready to seek ordination, the other developments ensued more or less as a matter of course. This series of events will chiefly concern us in this chapter. Back of that first big step stood years of indecision and perplexity, and even times of torturing doubt, as this narrative has taken some pains to show. Though his course at times seemed to be as much backward as forward, there was undoubtedly, especially in the latter years, a rather gradual movement towards the consummation. Not every stage is explicitly marked, but there appears to be a growth of commitment to the Christian faith, to Princeton Seminary as a cause representing a great principle, and to the Christian ministry as his calling. Exactly when the great decision was made, one cannot say, but he evidently had determined not later than the early summer of 1913 to appear before presbytery in the fall. Even then, however, there was still a degree of hesitation, but this was rather decisively removed during the summer as a result of a rewarding sojourn among the eastern and southern Alps. About a year later, Machen spoke of that holiday as just the breath of life to me, and as having had a very large place in enabling me to go forward and be ordained. Accordingly, it seems appropriate to dwell briefly upon it. A journey for health's sake. This sixth stay in Europe recalled earlier trips, and none more than his journey in 1905, since he spent most of it in the same general alpine regions on the border of Austria, where he had passed many exhilarating days in 1905. In respect of its occasion, however, the 1913 journey was entirely distinctive. Now his principal concern was not simply to see Europe, or to enjoy a holiday, or to master a language, or to pursue an academic course, or to act as companion for his parents, but to improve his health. The fact is that Machen had been feeling rather unwell for a considerable period. Prior to his 30th year, he seems generally to have enjoyed robust health. There were brief indispositions, but in most cases they disappeared quickly when he took time to secure relaxation from his usual labors. A long hike or regular tennis usually was all that was required to restore his accustomed vigor. During his student days at Princeton, he had once spent a number of days in the McCosh Infirmary with tonsillitis, and he seems afterward to have had recurrent attacks of sore throat in later years. Finally, in the summer of 1912, he underwent a tonsillectomy with a measure of improvement resulting. But before long, there came the disillusionment of his hopes that the operation would guarantee him against the recurrence of severe colds. The most distressing development of the year, and more that followed, however, was the onset of violent attacks of indigestion, which failed to respond to the remedy of Morrison's pills, by which his father had sworn for several decades, or any ordinary prescription. Following the close of the academic year in 1913, he felt so discouraged that he became convinced that he had to take some extraordinary measure in the hope of regaining his usual physical well-being and buoyancy. What could do, as well as exercise in the mountains, the all-sufficient medicine? And what mountains offered more inviting and challenging summons to engage all his powers than those of the Tyrol, the alpine crownland of western Austria? Leaving about the middle of June on the steamer Kaiser Wilhelm der Große, he proceeded upon arrival in Bremen to Munich, and after a brief stay in that charming city, he hurried on over the Brenner Pass into Tyrol. 8 years before, he had traveled leisurely on his bicycle. Now he went by rail in order to reach the mountain country as soon as possible. The 6 weeks that lay ahead were precious and had to be fully utilized for his special purpose. Whereas on the earlier occasion, Innsbruck and Linz had been the centers of operation, now Bozen, St. Ulrich, and Cortina were chosen. Working out from Bozen, he managed to cover considerable portions of the four valleys extending eastward and made several ascents, including the Grasleitenspitze, Kesselkugel, and Schlamm. St. Ulrich in the Grödner Valley made several groups of the Dolomite peaks accessible, and Cortina, the Zermatt of the Dolomite region, was the starting point for thrilling experiences in climbing Italian Alps, including Campanile di Valmontania, Monte Cristallo, and Monte Pellino. The final climb was that of the Kleine Zinne, which had also been ascended on his previous visit to this region. Now he was able to compare his present skill with his former aptitude, and he confessed that the impression of terrific and almost insurmountable difficulty is gone. While still cautious in making the steep ascents, he set speed records in traversing the slopes that amazed the guides. And at one point he boasts that knocking spots out of the guidebook time is the best remedy that I have yet secured for indigestion. In spite of such minor and major successes, in one respect at least, the stay in that area was disappointing. The weather, so it seemed, was constantly conspiring against him. Frequent torrential rains or freshly fallen snow or spells of warm weather interfered with his plans on several occasions. Once he spoke of the considerable delay occasioned by his observance of Sunday. The trouble with Sunday in the mountains is that it involves a wait not of 1 but of 2 days. Had today not been Sunday, I should have gone to the hut yesterday afternoon and made a climb today. As it is, I must wait till Monday afternoon to go to the hut, so that the climb cannot be made till Tuesday. But I am thankful for Sunday rest and do not regret my principles. In spite of much bad weather and the failure to make as much progress with his special problem of indigestion as he anticipated, he came to the close of his use of the mountain medicine with the assurance that it had done him a world of good. My summer, I think, has done me just lots of good, and I am very grateful to the Father who so wholeheartedly entered into the plan. The mental benefit of it has been as great as the physical. If there is any sphere of work where an occasional complete relaxation is beneficial, it is theology. Now, were it not for that worry about coming before presbytery, which fills me with dread, I should really look forward to taking up next year's work again at Princeton. My digestion, I regret to say, is still not quite perfect, but I think I have gotten over all acute trouble, and with a return to food, which I am more accustomed, I hope to be all right. Perhaps, however, the mental and spiritual benefits were far greater than the physical. Though the complete change of scene, the fresh air, and exercise toned up his system as a whole, he was not able to free himself entirely from his susceptibility to colds and indigestion. And most distressing of all, it was not long after he resumed life at the seminary in the fall that fierce attacks of indigestion again made his life miserable. Fearful that his work at the seminary would be seriously impaired or that it might even have to be suspended, he sought out a New York specialist for diagnosis and treatment. Acting on his advice, he spent virtually the whole of the Christmas vacation and a week beyond at his private hospital, a step taken the more reluctantly because he had been counting strongly on being an attendant at his younger brother Tom's wedding in December. The final diagnosis was chronic appendicitis and intestinal catarrh. Surgery, it is judged, could be avoided or at least postponed. But a program of medication and highly restricted diet was entered upon, and this was continued for more than a year until gradually he was able to resume a more normal existence and appeared to be permanently cured. Though he later on had his share of everyday miseries of mankind, perhaps more than he allowed anyone to realize, he evidently never again was called upon to pass through experiences comparable to those in his early 30s. Until the final week of his life, though one often has cause to wonder that he did not collapse under the overwhelming burdens that he carried, his health was on the whole exceptionally good, and his energy, both physical and mental, was so prodigious that far younger men despaired of keeping pace with him. Licensure and ordination. The extent of Machen's attachment to the church of his fathers, the Southern Presbyterian Church, is observed from the fact that he remained associated with it until shortly before his ordination. Since his field of labor was to be in the Northern Presbyterian Church, his ordination appropriately took place under its presbyterial auspices. But he had continued as a member of the Franklin Street Church of Baltimore, where he had been baptized and where he had made public profession of faith throughout the years of his instructorship at Princeton. Moreover, the preliminary steps looking towards ordination were taken in the presbytery of jurisdiction over his home church, the Presbytery of the Potomac. The date appointed for coming under care was November 3, 1913, and thus he placed himself on record as desiring to seek the sacred office. Following the traditional Presbyterian requirements, he then gave satisfaction as to experimental religion and his motives for seeking the ministry, and the presbytery in turn assumed supervision of his further preparation. At this stage, the required examination and pledge were quite simple, though the experience was a most solemn one since he had now undertaken a commitment which had first been proposed more than a decade earlier. During the nearly 6 months that followed before the time appointed for licensure, Machen was called upon to prepare the written parts of the trial, including a Latin thesis, a critical exegesis, a lecture, and a sermon. Since he was permitted to choose his own topics, none of these involved an immense amount of labor. His Latin thesis, for example, was on the subject of the birth of Christ. Nevertheless, it was not an exercise to be dashed off in an odd moment or two. As he wrote in the midst of preparations, "Of course, the Latin thesis has gotten to be more or less of a form, but still I should feel mortified to have mine too thickly peppered with atrocious solecisms." Finally, these exercises were completed, but the real ordeal was the appearance before the presbytery, which convened in Alexandria, Virginia, on April 22, 1914. He was thankful especially that the meeting was not to be held in his native city. "My only comfort about presbytery has been that the meeting is to be not in Baltimore, so I hope that none of my friends will go over to Alexandria. I should be glad to have them hear me preach, if I should preach, which is unlikely, but very sorry to have them hear me examined. Of course, I should not mind you, but it would at best not be worth your while. I should not mind Uncle if he should be sent to presbytery." Looking backward upon the experience afterward, however, he was light-hearted and relieved that no severe demands had been made upon him. "My experience with presbytery was on the whole good fun. It was a good Christian body of men, and with a cordial spirit which sometimes is lacking in this part of the world. Arriving at Alexandria about 9 o'clock on Wednesday morning, we found them engaged in devotional exercises. After the exercises were over, all of my examinations except experimental religion, church government, and theology were referred to committees. The committees were to meet during the recess. They were, however, conspicuous by their absence, or rather, they took a gratifyingly lenient view of their functions. The upshot of the matter was that the only examinations which I had to stand were those which came before open presbytery after lunch. My examination in church government was not passed very brilliantly, but when I could not answer the questions, the examiner answered them for me. In this way, embarrassment was avoided. The examination in theology was conducted by Dr. Kirk. The object of the examiner was to ask the candidate only those things which he would be most likely to know. Despite this fact, the answers were by no means what they might have been. The aetiological argument came in handy. I had looked it up in the syllabus of Dr. Patton's lectures in theism. Though I did not know much about what it is, yet I think the casual mention of it was rather impressive. At about 4 o'clock, I decided to go into Washington for gastronomic reasons. The excellent lunch provided for presbytery contained nothing which was not strictly forbidden on my diet list, and consequently I had practically nothing to eat since 6 o'clock in the morning. I was feeling a little rocky, but a good Orthodox dinner at the Willard at about 5 o'clock helped me get through the rest of the day. In preaching in the evening, I was for some reason not at my best, but my efforts seemed to be cordially received. I was sorry to rush off so hurriedly, but wanted to take the first car in order to be with Uncle. Of course, I was sorry that it did not seem proper for me to be ordained. For now, the whole bother will have to be gone over with before the dreadful New Brunswick Presbytery. But it is quite clear that the procedure which was adopted was the only correct one. I hope to present my letter at the June meeting of the New Brunswick Presbytery. Perhaps Uncle will stir the clerk up, whoever he may be, to send the letter along. Evidently, however, not everyone agreed with Machen's own perhaps half-serious, half-facetious estimate of the demands made of him. A short time later, his mother wrote of Dr. Kirk's appraisal. Dr. Kirk came to see us after the service and talked about you in a way that made my heart burn within me. He says that when you gain a little more experience and let yourself go, you will make a great preacher. That your sermon was remarkable in its depth of thought, your introduction was a masterful account of the steps by which a thoughtful soul struggles up to faith. You have given him a new idea. He talked very quietly and calmly, and said if I had been present, he was sure I would have been profoundly and humbly grateful. He spoke of the great satisfaction he felt in asking you questions on theology and meeting such perfect understanding and ready response. Another, not less sympathetic report was given Mrs. Machen by her brother, Thomas B. Gresham, who had been a delegate to Presbytery, and Uncle himself wrote on April 23rd. I was sorry not to meet you again last night, for I had hoped for an opportunity for expressing my joy and intense satisfaction with the way you came through your trial with the presbytery. As I told your mother this morning, it was a triumphal march, and I never saw a body of men so impressed as was this presbytery. Your sermon, too, was simply great and a fitting climax to the examination. I am delighted to hear that you have consented to preach for Dr. Kirk in June, and we all look forward to it. I am sorry we couldn't keep you in our presbytery, but I am sure the right thing was done in transferring you. And his brother Arthur's letter of congratulation contained the following. The news of the flattering impression you made at the meeting of the presbytery was exceedingly pleasant to all of us, and to nobody more pleasing than to me. always accepting mother, whose interest in each of us surpasses everything. It ought to be encouraging to you beyond words to know how highly you are esteemed and how much good you are capable of accomplishing and are accomplishing. According to all accounts, it must have been a triumphal acclamation rather than an examination. Cousin Louis H. Machen, who is practicing law in Alexandria, was present at the evening service and wrote his aunt that, "It would have done your heart good to hear the venerable chairman of the examining committee say publicly in the church tonight that he had never known such a brilliant Latin exegesis as Gresham's. He said the committee felt that they had some marvelous sort of leader in thought among them. Naturally, my family pride was keenly stirred. Gresham's sermon was the best I have ever heard from a young man. I was glad of this, for it had been rumored during the day that it was I who was going to preach." The chairman referred to was Dr. Park P. Flournoy, whose evaluation was perhaps more detached and objective than that of Machen's relatives and pastor. A month after the examination, he wrote Machen urging him to publish his exegesis paper in the Union Seminary magazine. Though complimented by this action, and admitting to his mother that the paper embodied the results of my experience in teaching for the past 10 years, he felt it was premature to publish it. It was this same Dr. Flournoy who had occasion more than a decade later to recall the examination to Dr. Albert Sidney Johnson of Charlotte, stating that, as the one who had been assigned the duty of examining and reporting on the Latin thesis and the Greek exegesis, he had reported both as the best of all that has been examined by me in the long course of such duties. In none of the reports of contemporary witnesses is there any mention of the act of licensure itself, though the taking of the constitutionally prescribed vows was actually the most meaningful event of the day. That Machen did exceptionally well in the examinations is not particularly surprising, considering his academic training and experience. But assenting to the questions for licensure was a different matter. That he did, after so many years of postponement, was noteworthy. That he did so at all, considering his former conviction that he probably would do wrong to seek ordination, and that at times he had been shaken by profound doubts as to the truth of Christianity, was memorable. That he did so at last is proof that, through the grace of God, manifesting itself in his own valiant struggle for truth and certainty, and utilizing the marvelous sympathy and patience of loved ones at home and senior colleagues at Princeton, he had emerged with steady and firm tread out of the morass that had threatened to hold him captive. Now at last he was ready to affirm solemnly that he believed the scriptures of the Old and New Testaments to be the Word of God, the only infallible rule of faith and practice, and to receive and adopt the Westminster Confession of Faith and Catechisms as containing the system of doctrine taught in the Holy Scriptures. Having arrived at such convictions through fierce struggle, and having counted the cost of such commitment, he could be expected to stand by them through thick and thin, regardless of the opposition that he might encounter by doing so. The ordination service took place about 2 months later, on June 23, 1914, at Plainsboro, New Jersey, just outside of Princeton. Though he had characterized the examination of the New Brunswick Presbytery as dreadful, no doubt with something of a twinkle in his eye, apparently it was not necessary to repeat his licensure examination to any considerable extent, and his admission seems to have been regarded as little more than a formality after his credentials had been received from the Southern Presbyterian Church. The total time set apart for the examination and Machen sermon was just 1.5 hours. Few details have been recorded. Rejoice with trembling. Incidentally, one discovers that the sermon was on the text, "Rejoice with trembling," taken from Psalm 2, verse 11, and a manuscript of that sermon is still extant. In it, he begins with the observation that rejoicing is power, that joy is the prime requisite for high achievement, that religion without enthusiasm is a dead thing. The religious life is indeed not a mere matter of inclination. It must be diligently and consciously fostered by attendance upon religious exercises, even when they are a weariness to the flesh, by maintaining the form of prayer, even when the spirit of it seems gone for the time without recall, by reading the Bible even when you are far more interested in something else. Duty is therefore necessary to religion, but religion that is only duty is but a dead thing. If the world is to be conquered for Christ, duty must be supplemented by mighty enthusiasm. Modern religion, with its emphasis upon good citizenship and social well-being, he went on to observe, is not really joyful. The happiness of the world is superficial and at best precarious. The thought of the real underlying problems of life cannot always be avoided. Browning's Bishop Blugman's apology was quoted to make this point. Just when we are safest, there's a sunset touch, a fancy from a flower bell, someone's death, a chorus ending from Euripides. And that's enough for 50 hopes and fears, as old and new at once as nature's self, to rap and knock and enter in our soul, take hands and dance there, a fantastic ring, round the ancient idol on his base again, the grand perhaps. The question was then raised, may we find in religion something deeper than the pleasures of this world, some peculiar basal joy, which will substantiate all the rest? There is the problem. How is religion to be made a joyful thing? The answer, he averred, is not to be found merely by cheering up religion. Noble churches, good music, brilliant preaching, these things in themselves are nonetheless worldly because enjoyed within consecrated walls. Sometimes they are not religion, but a diversion from religion. If it is recalled that religion is communion with God, men are ready with the answer that joy may be found by emphasizing the comforting attributes of God. But this approach, when examined, breaks down. In view of the reality of sin, men refuse to break forth into ecstasies of joy when they hear such a message. Moreover, such a message is shown to be false whether one appeals to nature or to the Bible as a whole or to Jesus only. How then may true joy be found? The text gives the answer, "Rejoice with trembling." That looks like a paradox. Joy and fear are opposite. At any rate, surely the trembling must limit the joy. Rejoice, although you have to tremble. Or rejoice, but in your joy do not forget to tremble. Or is the trembling positively necessary to the joy, intimately connected with it? Is the trembling the key to the joy? If we learn to tremble, will the way be open to the joy that we have sought so long in vain? Rejoice, says the modern preacher, but sadness somehow does not flee. Rejoice with trembling, says the psalmist, and the Lord put gladness in his heart. Men no longer tremble before God because they have lost their sense of mystery and their sense of sin, Machen now argued at length. Their minds should faint before the overwhelming mystery of the Creator as they contemplate the vastness of nature. If they kept close to the living stream of revelation in apostles and prophets, they would realize that they are dealing with unspeakable mysteries, and would not be too exact in charting the course of the Almighty, or too ready to say, because God does this, therefore he must do that. Others attack the transcendence of God, claiming that God does not exist apart from the world. Thus mystery has been eliminated from religion. But at what a cost? Inconvenient interference by the ruler of the universe is no longer to be expected. But no more is help in time of trouble. God has no more thunderbolts, but neither has he gifts. He is no longer to be feared, but neither is he worth seeing. Mystery is gone, but its place has been taken by despair. The sense of guilt also produced the fear of God, he went on, but that too has been lost. Sin is now viewed as a necessary stage in the development of humanity, and inevitably as necessary in the life of God too. The old view that sin is rebellion against the Creator's will is called morbid or even overwrought, but that settles nothing. Paul, too, was thought to be mad. Give up such madness and you sink to the level of the beasts. With it comes a terrible revelation of the righteous God. The search for joy in religion has seemed to end in disaster. God enveloped in impenetrable mystery and in awful righteousness, man confined in the prison of the world, trying to make the best of the situation, beautifying the prison with tinsel, yet secretly dissatisfied with his bondage. No hope. God separate from sinners. No room for joy. Only a certain fearful looking for of judgment and fiery indignation. Yet such a God has at least one advantage over the comforting God of modern preaching. He is alive. He is sovereign. He is not bound by his creation or by his creatures. He can perform wonders. Could he even save us if he would? He has saved us. It could not have been foretold. Still less could the manner of it have been foretold. That birth, that life, that death. Why was it done just thus, and then, and there? It all seems so local, so very particular, so very unphilosophical, very unlike what might have been expected. Are not Abana and Pharpar, rivers of Damascus, better than all the waters of Israel? Yes, what if it were true? So the All-Great were the All-Loving, too. God's own Son delivered up for us all. Freedom from the world, sought by philosophers of all the ages, offered now to every simple soul. Things hidden from the wise and prudent revealed unto babes. The long striving over, the impossible accomplished. Sin conquered by mysterious grace. Communion at length with the Holy God, our Father, which art in heaven. Surely this and this alone is joy, but a joy that is akin to fear. It is a fearful thing to fall into the hands of the living God. Were it not safer with a God of our own devising, love and only love, a Father and nothing else, one before whom we could stand in our own merit without fear? Let him who will be satisfied with such a God. But we, God help us, sinful as we are, we would see Jehovah. Despairing, hoping, trembling, half-doubting, half-believing, staking all upon Jesus, we venture into the presence of the very God, and in his presence live. Thus concludes this sermon that even stylistically bears the marks of its early origin. Later, Machen came to feel, on the background of criticism of loved ones, that he had been extreme in his use of brief and incomplete sentences. The sermon also no doubt expressed much of the religious temper of his mind and heart just at that time. What text could serve as well as it had served Christian in Pilgrim's Progress to voice his restraining and trembling sense of exultation? Yet the sermon theme was one that continued to appeal to Machen, for he often dwelt upon the majesty and transcendence of God and continued to preach on this particular text for many years. Among those who were present at the services were Machen's father and mother. Mrs. Machen was to rejoice in that event for years to come, and wrote as follows concerning it. "The memory of the ordination services abides in my memory, and that day of days will cast its radiance over many less favored ones. I wouldn't have had it different in any respect. The simplicity of it all, the little church, in its setting of greenery with flowers blooming about the door, the crowd of ministers in their everyday clothes, the absence of all form, and yet the strict following out of the scriptural idea, your own great sermon, all made it so deeply spiritual. Take away the inner meaning, and nothing was left. One felt that there was a great transaction, and God was taking part. I really felt that I can make a new surrender of my life to God, and that I can trust Him for others, too. One thing you said in your sermon has been of material help to your mother, about the mystery and transcendence of God. I have been resting in that. You made me feel the comfort of those awe-inspiring conceptions." Among those who took part in that service were Dr. Kirk and Bobby Robinson. The latter wrote that the whole ordination service had been a memorable experience, and that he felt that we did not bear witness alone to the realities of the faith. And Dr. Kirk expressed himself as follows. Baltimore, June 25, 1914. "My dear Gresham, I am very grateful to you for allowing me to have a share in your ordination. You realize how fully we all feel our prayers were answered, and I never from the beginning had any doubt but that God would direct you to a favorable conclusion in the matter. It fills me with great encouragement to see a man of such rare powers devoting himself to the noble but difficult task of preaching in these days, and with your absolute loyalty to the living Lord, your keen appreciation of historic Christianity, and your strong inclination towards scholarship, I feel confident that you will do a vast service to the church. I am proud indeed to have numbered you among my friends and church members, and shall count your friendship and sympathy in our common work among my highest blessings. With warmest affection, believe me always, yours sincerely, Harris E. Kirk." Nomination as Assistant Professor. Acting on the background of Machen's licensure, the faculty of the seminary was not slow to recommend his election as Assistant Professor of New Testament in its report to the Board of Directors at its meeting during the first week of May 1914. Dr. Warfield, who had been the president since Patton's retirement the previous year, reported that the recommendation had been adopted without opposition. His salary as an instructor had been eventually increased to $2,000, and it might now have been increased $500 more had not Machen made it clear to Warfield in advance that such a change would not increase but diminish my pleasure in my improved status. The reason for this feeling was, as he expressed it in a letter to his mother, that he would have felt like a dog in endangering a salary increase for another member of the staff, an increase imperatively required on account of his approaching marriage. His brother Arthur, who had himself just at this time been honored by an appointment as special assistant to Attorney General McReynolds, commented on this point in the course of his congratulatory message. "I want to congratulate you cordially upon your advancement to professorial rank. The honor is small recompense, I know, for your years of work. But it is satisfactory to find it given so promptly and willingly. That it is not accomplished by an increase in stipend is, I judge, due to your own modesty. My own feeling in such matters is that, however free one may be from mercenary motives, yet some adequacy in the pecuniary reward is desirable, because it does add a stimulus to one's zeal. It is very hard to render the very best service when you know that the service is not appraised at its real worth by those to whom it is rendered. But of course, in your case, these considerations are not applicable. Certainly not applicable to their full extent. I mention them merely in order that you may not hereafter be led to err by excess of unselfishness. It is a great pity that you should be so harassed with work, especially at this season of the year. You must really try next year to lighten your labors, that is to say, your routine labors, so as to leave you free to seize the opportunities for the highest usefulness when they present themselves. Sunday School Lessons. The work which was particularly harassing just at this time, and which constrained him to postpone his installation for nearly a year, was an exceedingly onerous burden of writing which had been undertaken some months previously. His labors in the local Sunday school were beginning to restrict his liberty of accepting preaching opportunities, and more than 2 years were to ensue before he would be able to secure release from his responsibility there. But these duties were child's play compared to the program of grueling work that he entered upon in response to an invitation of an editorial secretary of the Board of Christian Education to prepare the senior course of Sunday school lessons for a year. He did not undertake the work without misgivings. To mention one unattractive consideration, he felt that the outline of the course provided by the international lessons seemed, in a certain bias against historical facts, to be proceeding from a bad pedagogy and perhaps even a bad view of the Christian religion. But if he did not accept the invitation, would the work perhaps be undertaken by a liberal in theology? It is not so easy, he wrote to his mother, for conservatives to get a really free hearing. I am afraid, in order to get our views before the church, we shall have to adapt ourselves to circumstances. The course is in the apostolic age. It attracts me keenly. This is the kind of work that Princeton men ought to be doing. Of course, I should much rather write a book of my own on Paul, which would give me more scope for any power of expression which I may have, but the question is whether I could ever get my book published. The task that has been offered me is a humble one, and in it I shall be sadly hampered. But it is the thing that has come my way, and if I can, I want to take it. Beginning about 3 weeks from today, I shall be required, if I am approved, to hand in one lesson a week for both teacher's and pupil's book without fail, and the grind would go on for a year. Of course, if I want holidays, I can work ahead, but I must not get behind. The compensation offered is $1,000, which I was informed will prove to be not overly much in view of the work involved. And I can well believe it. It is evident that my work is going to be blue-penciled very freely, and some lessons I shall probably have to rewrite. This letter was written early in February. The agreement was entered into about 2 weeks later, and the work begun early in March. Though he had foreseen some of the difficulties, it is doubtful that he would have undertaken it had he been aware of all the toil and distress that were awaiting him. Just because his own standards were very high, even the obligation to write a more or less elementary course of lessons, with the deadlines coming up week after week for 52 weeks, became a hard taskmaster. Harassed by interruptions that were difficult to avoid at Princeton, he several times sought the tranquility and solitude afforded by a hotel room in one of the nearby large cities. The Vanderbilt Hotel in New York became a special favorite, and he often returned there when it became imperative to get some pressing work out of the way. During the summer of 1914, on one occasion he stayed there for about 2 weeks, and wrote at some length of its various advantages over Princeton. Aside from the delightful comfort of this hotel, the freedom from dust and dirt, the bed that is every bit as high in the middle as it is at the ends, the bully clean bathtub that empties or fills in 2 seconds, New York is always a great diversion to me. Trips to Europe under peaceful conditions may be fine, but it is hard for me to see how they can be much more delightful than 2 weeks at the Vanderbilt. Then, commenting on his delight in taking walks of several miles in New York and observing that they were very beneficial to his health, he said, "I suppose I am a born sightseer. With me it does not take the form of minute interest in museums or collections, or of antiquarian interest in historic associations. These things are to me too much like work. But I just love to walk and walk and walk, and get the general lay of the land, and see how the people live. For these purposes, Greater New York offers a never-ending variety of interest." The ease with which he could get just the things that he was allowed to eat at the time was another advantage, and there was the enjoyment of other diversions that appealed to him. But now he comes to the consideration which is responsible for the quotation of his letter in the present connection. This account of the pleasures of summer life in New York may perhaps create the impression that I have been having a big loaf, but such an impression would be far from correct. On the contrary, after rising rather early, I have gotten in pretty long mornings of work, which has also been continued during other parts of the day. Progress has been dreadfully slow, but the total volume of work has not been inconsiderable. Indeed, the fear of interruption is one of the things that keeps me from pulling up stakes. I do want to get a little ahead before I move again. This is such a satisfactory place to work. Beside the mountain of labor involved, however, there was another distressing aspect to the task of turning out the course of lessons. Editorial blue penciling had been foreseen as a possibility, but the actuality of it was sometimes gall and wormwood to his soul. At times, the editor silently changed the substance of what Machen had written, and the style was rather pervasively modified. Privately, which means in his communications with members of his family and with sympathetic friends at Princeton, he sometimes exploded. But it appears that in his correspondence, as well as in conferences with the editor, he was restrained and won recognition and praise not only for his thorough and scholarly work, but also for his helpful and gracious attitude. The necessity which Machen felt of taking up the numerous points and of ironing out the differences of judgment entailed an immense amount of additional labor. But the total result, at any rate, won praise not only from the editor, but also from colleagues and dear friends. Bobby Robinson found it admirable and encouraged him to continue to do what needs most to be done. Dr. L. B. Crane of Elizabeth, a seminary director of unusual scholarship, said that he did not believe that any such work has ever been done for Sunday schools. Dr. Warfield read the installments as they appeared, greedily at once, he said, and declared that Machen had done a very difficult piece of work admirably, and we are all proud to have these lesson helps emanate from Princeton. And Machen himself confessed, as the work reached a conclusion, that he had not always been entirely just to the editorial authorities of the church. "I am sorry about the spoiling of the teacher's book on the Gospels, but on the other hand, probably my style of writing was very faulty at first. In one way or another, I have got benefit from the experience of the year." History and Faith. However rewarding the year of hard work on the lessons had been, it was a relief to be able to enter upon a time of greater liberty to engage in a variety of challenging tasks. His installation lay just ahead, and it was necessary to prepare an address for the occasion. The day appointed for the service was May 3, 1915, and therefore the time available was not at all too long if he were to do justice to its demands. For the inaugural address, Machen chose the theme, History and Faith. The subject was as profound as any that he had ever treated in a public address, concerned as it was with a question that sharply divided the Orthodox Christianity represented by Princeton from opposing viewpoints at home and abroad. The view that faith might be valid regardless of one's conclusions concerning the history of Jesus Christ had been presented in a fascinating and captivating way by Hermann, and it had appeared increasingly that this or a similar viewpoint stood at the basis of a growing opposition or indifference to the gospel in ecclesiastical life in America. Hence, this utterance was most timely. Though it constituted a significant contribution to the subject under discussion, it was not weighted down with obscure allusions to critical discussions or with heavy technical apparatus. Machen did not indeed minimize the importance of debate with the critics, and as his 1912 articles on the birth narratives had shown, he could present minute and technical details if it suited his theme and purpose. But one temptation to which he seems never to yield, neither now nor later, was that of aiming to establish in the minds of his hearers or readers a reputation for scholarship. A distinguishing feature of Machen as a teacher and writer and preacher, which was really rooted in his character, was that he spoke or wrote with a view to the edification of his audience rather than to center attention upon himself. This was, in my judgment, the real secret of the lucidity of expression, which was a marked characteristic of his utterances. At his installation, accordingly, one feels that he was concerned to sound forth a clear note for the gospel, rather than to prove, for example, that the directors had made no mistake in judging that he possessed the requisite scholarship for his new position. Incidentally, of course, the address disclosed to the discerning ample evidence of scholarly equipment and discrimination. The address contains certain echoes of his ordination sermon and reflects some of the emphases developed in his work on the history of Christianity in his Sunday school course. But in the main, it was freshly concerned with its peculiar theme, taking account of the modern view that religion has been made independent, as it is thought, of the uncertainties of historical research. He characterized the separation of Christianity from history as an inspiring attempt, but as actually a failure. Give up history, and you can retain some things. You can retain belief in God. But philosophical theism has never been a powerful force in the world. You can retain a lofty ethical ideal, but be perfectly clear about one point. You can never retain a gospel, for gospel means good news, tidings, information about something that has happened. In other words, it means history. A gospel independent of history is simply a contradiction in terms. Considering the modern reconstruction of Jesus in the perspective of the Pauline epistles and the gospels, he showed why it must be considered a failure. In the first place, the natural and the supernatural in the gospel narrative are inextricably intertwined. If the supernatural is rejected, the whole must go. In the second place, even if one could reconstruct the historical Jesus by such a process of separation, that Jesus would be an impossible figure because of a tremendous contradiction that would remain at the very center of his being. For this teacher or prophet, who is not allowed to be thought of as more than a humble worshiper of God, supposed that he was the Messiah, a heavenly being who was to come on the clouds of heaven and be the instrument in judging the earth. In the third place, supposing that the critical sifting could be accomplished and that the resulting picture of Jesus were not self-contradictory, there would remain the insoluble problem as to how the Christian faith, with its belief in a superhuman Jesus, could have come into being. The modern substitute for the Jesus of the Bible, he concluded, has been tried and found wanting. The liberal Jesus. What a world of lofty thinking, what a wealth of noble sentiments was put into his construction. But now there are some indications that he is about to fall. He is beginning to give place to a radical skepticism. Such skepticism is absurd. Jesus lived, if any history is true. Jesus lived, but what Jesus? Not the Jesus of modern naturalism, but the Jesus of the Bible. In the wonders of the gospel story, in the character of Jesus, in his mysterious self-consciousness, in the very origin of the Christian church, we discover a problem which defies the best efforts of the naturalistic historian, which pushes us relentlessly off the safe ground of the phenomenal world toward the intellectual abyss of supernaturalism, which forces us, despite the resistance of the modern mind, to recognize a very act of God, which substitutes for the silent God of philosophy, the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, who, having spoken at sundry times and in diverse manners unto the fathers by the prophets, hath in these last days spoken unto us by his Son. The reference to the Bible attracts special attention on this occasion when vows spoken at the time of ordination were repeated. If this reference, and others that follow in the concluding words of the address, were taken as expounding Machen's total view of the Bible, they would seem rather inadequate. But it would be a mistake to insist that he was required by his theme or the occasion to deal systematically with this subject. His aim was the much more limited one of indicating the apologetic significance of the faithfulness of the biblical portrait of Jesus for the truth of the Bible as a whole. But he is not sympathetic with those who judge that the Bible is expendable. The Bible has been viewed as a ladder to scale the dizzy heights of Christian experience, which may be kicked down when one is once safely on top. But this figure, Machen felt, was misleading. The Bible is not a ladder. It is a foundation. It is buttressed, indeed, by experience. If you have the present Christ, then you know that the Bible account is true. But if the Bible were false, your faith would go. You cannot, therefore, be indifferent to Bible criticism. Let us not deceive ourselves. The Bible is at the foundation of the church. Undermine that foundation, and the church will fall. Two conceptions of Christianity are struggling for the ascendancy. The question that we have been discussing is part of a still larger problem. The Bible against the modern preacher. The church is in perplexity. She is trying to compromise. God grant that she may choose aright. God grant she may decide for the Bible. Personal tributes. This address was published in the Princeton Review, and copies were run off on orders of the Board of Directors for distribution to the 3,000 alumni of the seminary. The published form, however, did not contain all that Machen said on the occasion, for his files preserved a page of prefatory remarks which, because of their intimate and personal character, he decided or was persuaded not to include in the copy sent to the printers. He began by remarking that the position to which I have been called by the Board of Directors involves for me precious personal associations as well as an inspiring task. And then he spoke particularly of his obligations to and esteem for Professor Armstrong. The professor in charge of the department in which I am to labor has made of me an intimate personal friend and bestowed upon me 1,000 kindnesses. My impression of his scholarship was formed during the very first hour that I spent in his classroom, and has been immeasurably deepened since that time. The assistance that he has given me in the establishment of my Christian faith has been simply incalculable. I shall never be able to acquire one-tenth part of his learning, but to his constant guidance and example, I shall owe at least whatever breadth of outlook and loyalty to the truth I may ever be able to attain. My dependence upon him has become only more and more apparent, and to me more and more welcome, with successive years. How Machen must have rejoiced in this opportunity of saying publicly just how great a man his beloved army really was. His letters home gave him repeated occasions to do so, and they glow with admiration and affection when they mention him. When Armstrong had been attacked by certain students in 1909, Machen could hardly speak publicly in his defense. He could only mourn in the deepest sympathy. But now he could speak forth with complete propriety, and the biographer, as one who, though from a greater distance, came many years later to share something of that admiration and affection for Armstrong, takes special delight in the fact that this work may be the means of publishing Machen's tribute. But there was one other who was singled up for special mention on the occasion of Machen's installation. It was Dr. Patton, who had consented to giving the charge to the newly installed professor. Of him he said, "The distinguished preacher, who has done me the honor of delivering the charge on the present occasion, has been to me, since I came to Princeton, my spiritual father. For him I cherish every bit of gratitude and affection of which I am capable. No one else in the wide world could possibly have filled the place that he has filled in my life. Without his sympathy and help, you may be very sure that I should not be standing before you today." Finally, he referred more generally to the rest of the faculty as known and honored for many years. He recalled that he had sat under most of them in the classroom and declared that "they are all today at least my teachers." And then he introduced his theme as follows: "Personal associations such as these afford immeasurable encouragement for the work in which, by the grace of God, I hope to be engaged. The general purpose of that work may perhaps be outlined, in a sadly inadequate and elementary way, I am afraid, in what you are now permitting me to say with regard to history and faith." That Machen did feel that the address was not up to his best possibilities was expressed later on in a letter to his father. "I should have originally preferred not to print the address at all, which is exceedingly light and lends itself to spoken discourse rather than to the printed page, but have gotten somewhat into the notion of the thing now. I should not like to have the few experts into whose hands it may come take it as a fair sample of what I can do. A similarly wide distribution of my Jesus and Paul would have given me much more pleasure, for I am bold enough to think that in that article I said something in a way which, right or wrong, is at any rate somewhat distinctive. This time I have simply given a sketch of well-worn arguments." To this his father, who with his mother had been present at the service of installation, responded with the encouragement that could still be counted upon in his 88th year. "I have read History and Faith all through very carefully, and the impression I received at the delivery has been fully confirmed. You need not doubt that the wide circulation given it by the seminary trustees was well justified. It will hold its own, whenever and wherever read. This you may feel assured of. True, it does not occupy the same ground as Jesus and Paul, nor does Jesus and Paul crowd out the critical article which exhorted the commendation of Harnack. Each piece of work has its own place, and I am rejoiced that you have been able to accomplish them all. Your work for the Sunday school lessons is admirable too, and has given us a great deal of pleasure and profit to read, as I must not omit to say in connection with this comparative discussion. We are all feeling pretty well. For myself, I have a lot of jobs, professional and other, which I am desiring to dispose of in preparation for the long vacation. So I am kept right busy, the right road to happiness in life, after all. Your affectionate father, Arthur W. Machen. Another faithful supporter was Dr. John DeWitt, now in retirement, who wrote, I read, with even greater pleasure than the pleasure I had in hearing it, your inaugural discourse, terse, strong, and clear, and every way most admirable. He added, however, the comment that Machen might have given more words than you did to the internal arguments by which the Bible authenticates itself, and above all to the Testimonium Spiritus Sancti. Among others who offered their congratulations was President Hibden of the university and Jesse Benedict Carter, director of the American Academy in Rome. The latter had inadvertently opened a copy of the address intended for another whose forwarding address was unknown, and said that he had received so much pleasure from reading it that he was selfishly unwilling to return your article to you on general principles, and that I have seldom read anything which has pleased me more. And when I noticed the footnote that you are to be professor of New Testament literature and exegesis, I was more pleased still, for that is the sort of spirit in which, it seems to me, New Testament literature should be treated. Thus, Machen was formally inducted into the office which he was to hold for the rest of his stay at Princeton, a period of 14 years. But already the previous year, following upon his election, he had been accorded the right of voting privileges in the faculty, and thus was qualified to take direct part in the government of the seminary, so far as the authority of the faculty was concerned. It was just at that time that momentous developments affecting the seminary's future were taking place, and it is therefore necessary to retrace some of our steps so as to look beyond the horizon of Machen's personal history to the larger circle of the life of the seminary as a whole.